This is the Berkeley Signal.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those gnats in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the feel that this ain't exactly real, or it's real but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
Coming to the USA. to Ned, getting lost in that hopeless little screen. But I'm stubborn as those garbage bags of time cannot decay. I'm junk, but I'm still holding up this little wild bouquet. Democracy is coming to the USA.
A year and a half of Trump's presidency is more than most Americans have been able to tolerate. The levels of corruption and overt flouting of the U.S. Constitution, the race baiting, the demagoguery, the misogyny, and more are unprecedented. The U.S. has perhaps never before had such an impeachable president as Trump. Now, a new book written by three veteran constitutional lawyers makes the case that Trump's impeachment is imperative and that, in fact, the U.S. Constitution itself demands it. Ron Fine is legal director of the group Free Speech for People. He's a constitutional lawyer who previously served as assistant regional counselor in the U.S. EPA. And he's the co-author with John Bonifaz and Ben Clements of the new book, The Constitution Demands It, The Case for the Impeachment of Donald Trump. Welcome to the program, Ron.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So we had interviewed Alan Lichtman very early in Trump's presidency, who wrote the book predicting that Trump would be impeached and laid out this detailed set of cases around any one of which could make a good case for impeachment. Your book comes out a year and a half into the presidency, and it seems as though every other day there's a new reason that Congress could use to impeach Trump. How would it work? Let's remind our audience what the mechanics of impeachment are so that we can discuss whether it's actually a feasible thing.
Sure. So the Constitution provides that the president can be impeached and removed from office for high crimes and misdemeanors, which is a phrase we can talk about later. And the basic process is that it starts in the House of Representatives, which usually begins by investigating the charges through a committee, such as the Judiciary Committee. And then if the Judiciary Committee recommends articles of impeachment, then the full House would have to approve articles of impeachment by a majority vote. And if the House does that, then it goes to the Senate for a trial. And the trial is held, and then if two-thirds of the senators vote to convict the president, then he is removed from office.
So the House is where it starts. And of course, all eyes are on the midterm elections, where there are predictions that Democrats could flip the House. So we can talk a little bit more later about the feasibility of it. What are the cases that you lay out in your book, the most egregious violations of the U.S. Constitution that the House could use to start impeachment proceedings?
So in the book, we lay out eight grounds for impeachment hearings. And of these eight, it's important to know that two of them overlap with Special Counsel Mueller's investigation, and six of them don't. And that's important to know because a lot of people are under the impression that impeachment has to wait until the special counsel completes his investigation. But of our eight grounds, six of them have nothing to do with the Mueller investigation. And these are broad ranging because they include all of the corruption and abuse of power that we've seen. They started with a violation that the president was committing from the moment he took the oath of office, which is violating the Foreign and Domestic Emoluments Clauses of the Constitution, which are provisions that prevent the president from taking money from foreign government or domestic governments. And they include obstruction of justice, soliciting foreign help from the Russian government in the election campaign, abuse of the pardon power, directing law enforcement to persecute political adversaries, and several other grounds. And a key point of this is that any one of these is sufficient to start impeachment hearings. When you put them all together, the case is overwhelming.
The parts of the Constitution that are violated in this, you would imagine that this would be a huge issue with Republicans who claim that the U.S. Constitution is the basis for their actions, that it's a sacred document. They claim the mantle of patriotism. You know, Trump has made so much about saluting the flag during the national anthem, but when it actually comes to respecting the document that lays out the framework for our democracy. He has shown how little respect he has for it. I want to just stay on the emoluments clause for a minute because that's such a critical one. Trump came into this presidency as a businessman. We have not really, as far as I can remember or as far as my history knowledge goes, had a president that has had this many businesses under his control as Trump when taking the office of the presidency. What could he have done to not violate the emoluments clause? Would it have meant walking away from his entire business and all his corporations?
So there were a number of options that were available to Trump. And during the transition period between the election and the inauguration, a lot of people, including some former chief ethics counsels for previous presidents, Democrat and Republican, offered to advise Trump on how he might be able to do this. The answer is ultimately that it's the president's responsibility to figure out how to make his personal assets fit with the requirements of the job rather than to try and bend the Constitution to be able to hold on to his businesses however he wants. But the gold standard in a case like this is what's called a blind trust, in which he would have had his businesses need to be, in his case, because they're so personally associated with him, they would have needed to be sold off. And then his assets could be invested by a trustee who would not tell Trump what it was that he owned. And many previous presidents have been wealthy. Some have owned businesses, and they've all used different mechanisms to fit into these constitutional requirements. Most famously, Jimmy Carter sold a peanut farm in Georgia in order to make sure that he wasn't violating any of these provisions.
Right, because if there was even a whiff of impropriety that somebody wanting to curry favor with Carter might have gone and wanted to, you know, buy up a bunch of peanuts from his peanut farm and then ask for something in return, that would have essentially been an abuse of power, conflict of interest. But with Trump, you have foreign diplomats and anybody who's looking to have a word with the president or show how much they support the president, they can go and stay at the Trump International Hotel in Washington, D.C. when they go for visits to the nation's capital. And when it comes to choosing which hotel to stay at, why would they not choose Trump's own hotel that personally benefits him? This should have been, you know, the main impeachable offense, but it seems to have gotten lost in all of the other issues that keep getting raised around Trump.
Well, I think it set a bad tone because the fact is that the president was violating this from the moment he took the oath of office, and Congress basically did nothing about it. Now, if Congress had said, you need to, you know, solve this problem immediately or else we're going to start impeachment proceedings, if Congress had done that early on, then that would have given Trump a sense that he was restrained, that he couldn't do whatever he wanted with impunity. But instead, because of Congress's inaction, Trump early on learned the lesson that he could get away with a lot.
I'm glad you put it at the feet of Congress, because the Republican Party seems to have sacrificed the Constitution in order to further their political agenda. And Trump knows that, and they know that. The Republican Party controls, until, you know, at least for the next few months, Congress. Is it essentially this party's responsibility for allowing all of these things to take place? Or have the Democrats also failed? Some have spoken about impeachment, but it seems as though even the Democrats haven't strongly raised it.
Yeah, I think both parties are to blame here. And the Democratic Party leadership has consistently shut down efforts to even raise the question of impeachment. There have been some members of the House, such as Al Green and Steve Cohen and Brad Sherman and Maxine Waters, who have taken a role in speaking about impeachment or even bringing things to the House. But the leadership of the Democratic Party, as well as the Republican Party, has consistently tried to stifle that. And I think both parties are making a short-term political calculation that is really putting the long-term interests of the nation in second place to their own party interests.
Let's talk about the issue of definitions and vagueness. The term high crimes and misdemeanors is a very vague term. Can the Republicans make a case that nothing that Trump has done actually fits that bill, and that people are, you know, who want to impeach him are just against him because he's a bold president and they don't like the fact that he's a businessman? What do high crimes and misdemeanors mean?
Yeah, in the book, we lay out the case for why each of these grounds meet that standard. High crimes and misdemeanors is a term that the framers of the Constitution inherited from the legal practice in England, where Parliament would impeach officials for high crimes and misdemeanors. And it meant, at the time, serious offenses, which may or may not be crimes, and they could include abuses of power, abuses of the public trust. But the key point is that they're offenses committed committed by politicians against the country itself. They're not minor crimes. They're not sort of purely personal offenses. These are offenses that threaten the very foundations of the rule of law and constitutional democracy.
The book that you've written also lays out several other bases for impeachment that are about how Trump has fomented violence, encouraged violence, and all levels of violence, whether against individuals, aimed at countries, or even against the entire press industry. Can you lay those out for us? He has been quite specific, and his Twitter feed would essentially offer plenty of documentation for the kind of violence he's called for, right?
Yeah, and this is all out in the open. So this is a good example of something that's not dependent on the Mueller investigation. It's not about finding a secret tape. This is all public information. But since the election campaign itself, when Trump was often exhorting people who were at his rallies to beat up protesters, to knock the crap out of them and so forth, he's been continuously advocating for illegal violence. In one case, he told an audience of police officers they should be rough with suspects and manhandle them and bang them on the head as they got into a squad car. In another case, he basically advocated committing war crimes against Muslims, and he's often retweeted inflammatory videos. And when you put this all together, maybe you would say any one incident by itself wouldn't rise to the level of an impeachable offense. But the president has the obligation to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, to protect the country against domestic insurrections, like the type of neo-Nazi marches that we saw in Charlottesville last year, in which he said there were problems on both sides and he praised very fine people among the white supremacist marchers. And he also has an obligation to ensure the equal protection of the laws. And this is an area where the president has not just failed, but has actively trampled on these obligations.
So the constitutional responsibility to protect the nation from violence is what he is violating by being the source of the inspiration for violence, right? I mean, we are seeing people who commit violent acts literally citing Trump personally when engaged in hate crimes, verbal or physical abuse. That is pretty damning.
And they call it the Trump effect. And there have been studies that have shown that starting with the election campaign in 2016, but continuing, that when Trump is giving a rally in a city, violence increases, often racial incidents increase. The name Trump has turned into a race-baiting cry. So if there's someone chanting Trump, Trump, Trump at, let's say, a high school basketball game, everybody understands what that means, particularly if one of the teams is from a community that's predominantly of color. So he's actively fomenting this type of violence. He may not explicitly call for it on one particular occasion, as he did during the campaign, but his rhetoric and his actions promote it.
And then on the violence that he has called against the media, that I'm assuming is a violation of the First Amendment. When the president labels the media the enemy of the people, when he posts on his Twitter feed a doctored video of him punching out person embodying an entire media network, in that case CNN, he's essentially violating the First Amendment of the Constitution?
There have been court cases where freedom of the press or freedom of speech was found to be violated by a government official giving this type of pressure. But what's really important to note is that this is not just one incident. And we waited a while before we were ready to say that there was enough to call this a ground for impeachment hearings on its own, because one tweet wouldn't necessarily rise to that level. But when you put it together with all of his rhetoric about the press being the enemy of the American people, when he's threatened to use law enforcement to punish the independent press, when he's pressured news companies to fire particular reporters based on stories he doesn't like, when he's threatened to use the Postal Service to raise shipping rates on Amazon as an indirect way of punishing the Washington Post because they share an executive, this all together is a way that undermines the freedom of the press. And one thing that we've seen in other democracies that have slipped out of constitutional democracy, like Turkey or Venezuela, is that strongman leaders have found that you can undermine the press even without direct censorship.
And there is news now that Trump is essentially going to be launching Trump TV, which is somewhat strange that you would have this president who's creating his own media empire. And often that's seen as another hallmark of authoritarian governments, right? Government control of media, not just attacks on independent media, but then control of their own media network. What about the family separation issue in the immigration debate with violence that Trump's very direct decision of so-called zero tolerance for immigrants coming into the U.S. across the border, the cruelty of family separation has done very serious harm to children. Does that rise to the level of violating the U.S. Constitution? One would hope it would.
Yeah, this is an issue that was coming to public light just as we were finishing the book. So we mentioned it briefly. We're now calling that a ninth ground for impeachment hearings, and it is based on cruel and unusual punishment of children and their families by using this detention policy as a means of basically punishing the parents for something that's actually, in most cases, immigration violations are actually just a misdemeanor offense, and to warehouse children in internment camps, cruel and unusual punishment of the children who have done, in many cases, nothing wrong, and of the parents who, in many cases, have done nothing wrong or at most a misdemeanor violation.
Trump's national security advisor, John Bolton, has threatened U.S. sanctions against international criminal court judges if they proceed with an investigation into alleged war crimes committed by U.S. troops in Afghanistan. In 2016, an ICC report accused the U.S. military of torturing at least 61 prisoners in Afghanistan during the ongoing war. The report also accused the CIA of subjecting at least 27 prisoners to torture, including rape at CIA prison sites in Afghanistan, Poland, Romania, and Lithuania. John Bolton also threatened to directly target judges at the ICC. During his speech, John Bolton also announced the Trump administration would close the Palestine Liberation Organization's office in Washington in response to a Palestinian effort to push the ICC to investigate Israel for war crimes. Palestinian diplomat Saeb Erekat criticized the move. For more, we're joined by Jamil Dakwar, director of the American Civil Liberties Union's Human Rights Program. Jamil, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you talk about what John Bolton is saying, the significance of his Federalist Society speech yesterday on the sanctioning of the ICC, saying he will not allow ICC, International Criminal Court judges, into the United States because of they might be investigating the United States and Israel for possible war crimes?
Unprecedented attack on the rule of law. This is unheard of, that we have a government and a country that has committed acts of torture in another country, and the country itself, the United States, failed to hold any official accountable for acts of torture by the CIA, by the U.S. military during the armed conflict in Afghanistan. And that happened during the Bush years, and then Obama administration failed to take the comprehensive, thorough investigation into those acts and said, we will look forward, not backward. And now we're seeing a Trump administration doubling down on their assault on international law and human rights and the fighting impunity by saying we will now go against the same body that is a last resort for victims of torture, that is the only international institution recognized as the one that is supposed to investigate and prosecute war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. And the Trump administration is saying we will be treating your judges and prosecutors like drug traffickers, like war criminals, instead of admitting that there was a failure in holding officials accountable. So John Bolton basically is the same John Bolton he was when he was in the Bush administration. He was the same one. He made destroying the court a lifetime project and goal. The difference now, he is in the place where he can do more than what he was doing in the Bush years. So this very dangerous attack on the international body that where 123 countries are member, many of them are close U.S. allies, particularly in Europe, that is supposed to defend this body. And yet we see John Bolton perhaps wants to score points with people who are supporting Trump in the United States by invoking distorted and misinformation about the fact that the court is likely to investigate crimes that actually do not exist under the statute, under the law of the ICC. We are in a tipping point where the administration is basically saying we are going to have a frontal attack on judges and prosecutors and personnel. By the way, there is no legal theory to support that. How is it that they will be prosecuting judges for the mere fact of conducting their job and responsibility under an international treaty that is recognized again and ratified by 123 countries? What is also concerning and very dangerous is that the threat is not just against the judges and the prosecutors and the personnel of the court, but it's also against any state or party that is willing to assist the ICC in its investigation of U.S. war crimes in Afghanistan, Lithuania, Romania, and Poland. These are the three countries where the CIA had black sites where people were tortured. And that means that they are sending this threat to virtually anyone who would be in a position to assist the ICC. Does that include lawyers? Does that include individuals, organizations here in the United States, lawyers who represented torture victims, including us as the ACLU? What is it that the Trump administration wants to do? But ultimately, they're seeing that the ICC is about to open a full investigation into torture in Afghanistan. As the report said, this investigation is not only against the United States. It's the United States and Afghan forces, Taliban forces, who are part of the armed conflict in Afghanistan. What makes it so important and significant here is that the United States is the country that has the longest tradition of upholding the rule of law and having an independent investigative bodies and judiciary to investigate acts of torture when they occur. And yet it failed to do so. That's why the ICC is stepping in. The ICC is not stepping in in just for the sake of, how Bolton put it, just to undermine U.S. sovereignty. This is really nonsense. They are stepping in because we failed, the United States failed to uphold the rule of law. It failed to investigate acts of torture that were well documented by the Senate torture report that was published, or at least partially declassified, in December of 2014. We're in a position where we see an escalation in attack on international bodies. This is the same administration that withdrew from the Human Rights Council. This is the same administration that is now changing the rules of engagement with regard to the use of targeted killings. This is the same administration that is pulling out of international treaties, including the Paris Accord, which you talked about. So we're very concerned about that, but I think we need to put it into perspective. This is the same Trump administration that has a abysmal record on human rights here in the United States and is trying to encourage other countries to follow its pattern, the pattern of disregarding the rule of law, disregarding international law, and basically saying that there are certain countries that are above international law, that they should enjoy immunity, should not be prosecuted and investigated. The United States, after all, is the one that actually conducted these operations, military operations, intelligence operations that were involving torture and prolonged detention of detainees in Afghanistan. And that's why I think we ought to step back and not to buy into the false and misinformation that is being spread by John Bolton without basis in U.S. law as to threaten prosecutors and judges and so forth.
And what about the U.S. closing the PLO's offices in Washington in retaliation for them pushing for Israel to be investigated for war crimes in the occupied territories, Jamil?
It follows the same kind of argument. The administration is basically arguing that Israel has a very robust judicial system that would investigate war crimes in Gaza or the West Bank. We know from Human Rights Watch, from Amnesty International, from Israeli organizations like B'Tselem, Palestinian Human Rights Organization, that there were no full independent investigations into war crimes into Gaza. That's why the Palestinians sought justice before the ICC. It is because there was no recourse for victims. There was no recourse for people who were killed by bombings in Gaza, by other violations of international law. And that's been ongoing for a long time, that they decided to take that step of seeking justice at international level. And yet now the Trump administration is trying to use the Israeli case as a way to kind of protect itself from its own war crimes in Afghanistan, in other countries where the CIA had operated black sites. And I think that ultimately, it's about whether this administration will be allowed to breach international law, to act as if it's a country that does not follow international law. When the United States wants to use international law, it does so probably very effectively against its adversaries. When it comes to very close allies, it turns to give them a pass. It turns to say, no, the law doesn't apply here. They should not be recognized as a jurisdiction of the ICC just because it harms U.S. interests. I think that is an opportunity for us to talk about the United States, whether it's the United States is really fulfilling and playing a role of a fair and really a true champion of human rights and upholding international law, while we see again and again examples where it is not doing that. It's actually going to protect those perpetrators of war crimes. What does that say about other situations of the ICC, for example, that are still pending? The ICC has about 22 situations that are being, whether it's ongoing investigations or preliminary investigations, including places like Georgia, with the armed conflict between Georgia and Russia. They just announced recently preliminary investigation that will be in the Philippines and the war on drugs and the atrocities that are happening there. What is the message that the Trump administration is sending to those governments as far as the way that they should be treating the ICC, the judges and prosecutors, and whoever is assisting those ICC investigations? So this really goes to the core of fundamental principles of defending human rights and human dignity and fighting impunity.
Jamil, I wanted to get to UNRWA, the UN agency that supports Palestinian refugees in the occupied territories and beyond, 5 million people. The U.S. saying it's cutting off all funding.
Again, this goes to the pattern of what serves this administration's political agenda. Does it really serve the interests of U.S. interests, long-term U.S. interests? Does it really understand the consequences of cutting aid to hospitals in East Jerusalem that are providing cancer treatment to Palestinians? Does it really help to close down the educational institutions that helped educate refugees? The U.S. has been a long supporter of many institutions that helped provide aid to refugees, including to UNRWA. And yet it is clearly part of that agenda of attacking refugees, attacking anything that is really standing in the way of Trump's agenda and his political priorities, particularly with when it comes to its alliance with Israel, when it comes to seeing refugees as enemies rather than people who deserve to seek asylum and refuge and safe haven. So I think that one have to be really wondering, where is the administration taking? What is the message that are being sent by shutting down aid to humanitarian organizations, by attacking the credibility and the legitimacy of an international court that is upholding international humanitarian law and international law more broadly, particularly where, in a time when we see that there's more and more war crimes, more and more crimes against humanity committed everywhere, and there is a need for accountability so that there will be consequences for not just acts of torture, but, you know, for much wider scale atrocities that we've seen in other places in the world. And yet, this administration is saying, following Trump's dangerous America First agenda, is trying to abandon, in some way, some good things that the United States did. After Nuremberg, the United States supported many of the international war crimes tribunals, particularly in the 90s, leading to the establishment of the ICC. And I think that it's important for us here in America to understand why this matters, because the ICC, after all, is trying to help preserve humanity, is trying to fight impunity. And if the United States will become the enemy of this ICC court, people will have a different view of the United States. It will have consequences for the United States and its relationship, particularly with member states in Europe, where they have to abide by the international obligations under the ICC to defend the ICC and to also cooperate with the ICC. That will be difficult for the ICC to conduct a thorough investigation if this investigation that is imminent to be authorized by the pretrial chamber. It will meet a lot of hurdles. But I think it's important for us to understand that this attack is really unprecedented. It will only make it worse for any future where we can see accountability and justice, and we can see some sort of a deterrent against those governments that are trying to undermine international law for the sake of their own nationalist or other kinds of interests that are similar to what Trump is trying to do here.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
The black survivors.
The emperor's lions are like enormous pet dogs.
The black survivors.
Here we go.
How can you be sitting there telling me that you care, that you care, when every time I look around, the people suffer in the suffering, in every way, in every way. Some people got everything, some people got nothing, some people got hopes and dreams, some people got ways and means. Na-na-na-na-na.
Here we go.
The black survivors.
The lion is Cuba.
The black survivors. The black survivors.
The lion is Cuba.
The black survivors.
Goes to the people, plus there's a conflict, cause the people who sold the people refuse to be equal. same old story, no sequel.
The black survivor.
We all must live as one, but the convict lies unless we all get some. Gold, silver, and the diamonds that we all mining. Got to get mines, we got to get
the
mines.
The black survivor. It's mine. The black survivor.
It's mine.
The black survivor.
It's mine.
The black survivor.
It's mine. Here we go.
The black survivors.
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 I teach at SF State. And every year we ask our students where they get their information from. And with each year, more and more relying not on radio or television, but they're getting it from other places. We can understand that with the advent of technology. But what is also kind of interesting is how much they are gravitating towards entertainment, gossip. TMZ would probably be a main source of information above and beyond anybody on this table. And so that creates a situation as to, one, if you're doing traditional news, do you have to move in the direction of TMZ? And then for somebody like Van, who, you know, runs shop over there, does he see himself having to move in the direction of providing relevant news and information since so many people are now looking at where he's at? So let's start off the conversation, and we'll start off with you, Kristen. You work at KPIX. How are you seeing the changing landscape from your vantage?
I think there is an acknowledgement that particularly when it comes to younger viewers, that fewer people are sitting there and waiting for the news to come on at 5 and 6 o'clock. Tune in and watch a full 30 minutes of news. That's not what's going on. And what that means is it's changed the way we gather news. It's changed the way we put news out there. It's changed what the definition of a reporter. So in depending on what station you're talking about, most local news stations here in the Bay Area have, you know, reporters who are working not only as the person asking the question or conducting interviews, but also shooting their own stories, editing their own stories, acting as their own camera person, their reporter, and their own editor. And so we see some level of that happening at different stations. We also see news being streamed. We see news updates happening all throughout the day. I know we've started a PIX live stream that I believe updates people every hour or so about what's going on in the news. So it's creating a lot more work for the journalists on the ground. And at the same time, it has the impact of making it so that you have fewer journalists doing more jobs, if that makes sense. And that can, in some ways, impact your storytelling, your story gathering, your fact-checking. When you are putting news out at a more and more rapid pace with a smaller staff doing more jobs and wearing more hats, that has an impact. And so I think we've certainly seen situations where we have news gathering happening and happening very quickly and not being fact-checked the way that it should, not, you know, having the number of eyes on it that you would have had in the past. And so I think that's something that we have to be honest about, that that is a shift, and that if you are, you know, using smaller staffs and having people do more things, there are some things that are going to slip through the cracks sometimes.
So let me ask you this then. If I put on my OG hat now.
Now you're an OG. Okay.
Right? If I go back to the 70s when I was, you know, there was a time when it was really paramount that reporters just do what they need to do. If you're covering, say, a session like this, it didn't matter whether it made the ratings or not. This was an important story to tell. Right? Black folks on a Saturday afternoon gathered to talk about media, right? But now there's always been this pressure to get ratings. And if you could address that, and then adding to that, the fact that, you know, I started off by saying more people are interested in the entertainment, the pop stories. Do you find yourself under that pressure? You know, like if you were to cover this story, or if Too Short was down the street, where would they send your camera? Or if Cardi B was fighting down the block, you know, where you gonna go?
We'd be all over Cardi B, obviously. No, I think that's a tricky question. I think, you know, when I hear people talk about media bias, first of all, it's a very vague term. And even when you say media, I don't know what media you're talking about. I don't know if you're talking about TMZ or local news or Armand on The Quiet Storm, you know. But in my view, television journalism in particular is, if there's a bias, they're biased toward good pictures, good visuals, something that's going to make you sit in your seat and arrest your attention. And I think we have to actually be careful with how much we rely on that, because it does have the impact of narrowing down the stories that we do to stories that are blood and guts, crime, violence, you know, that sort of thing. And we stop looking at the stories that actually matter to this community. It's the biggest, and I say that, you know, I don't have a problem being a critic of television news, because I'm out there in the street every day and I talk to people who say, you know, I used to watch a lot, I don't watch anymore, it's so depressing, I can't, you know. And so, and I get that. I think news people have, you know, we have these brains that sort of hear certain buzzwords or see certain types of video, and we have all of these smartphones out there recording video and sending it to us all the time of things happening. And sometimes, you know, that blows open stories like police brutality, you know, and sometimes it's just Cardi B getting in a fight. So I think it's on us, you know, to kind of step back outside of our, you know, news bubble and really get in the community and figure out what people want to see, what's important for the community.
Do you have the freedom to run up there and say, look, I'm going to cover this, or do they dictate where you're going to go and how you're going
to
do it?
I think it varies from station to station. I would say I've been at KPIX for about 8 years. I think I have built up a lot of trust with management there. We're going through some shifts with management right now. And I also cover the East Bay specifically, and they are over in San Francisco, and so they sort of trust me to know what's going on there. That doesn't mean the stories that I pitch always get picked. And so oftentimes I'm going in there trying to, you know, represent what I think is happening in Oakland that we should be listening to, that we should be covering. And that's not what they want to hear that day. You know, they want to go cover, you know, the shooting on 98th or whatever, you know. And so it's this push-pull, it's this tug-of-war every day. I'm also one of very few Black people on air or behind the scenes at my job as well. And so I feel that pressure to represent everybody, and I take it on. You know, I'm happy to go out there and do the Black stories. Give it to me, you know. I'd rather myself be doing it than someone else. I will say this. Our station recently allowed us to do a half-hour documentary, unheard of. Okay, I get in trouble if my story is over a minute and 45 seconds. But a half-hour documentary on the opening of the Lynching Museum in Montgomery, Alabama. We traveled there. Thank you. No, I appreciate that. But that was something that, you know, I sort of co-teach a class at Berkeley, and that was something I was inspired to do from working with those students who are so passionate and so driven and just go out there and make these stories happen. I never would have asked to do that story had it not been for sitting with those students going, hey, maybe I could do something cool too. And my station actually listened and let us do it, and it was a life-changing opportunity, but that's rare.
Okay, so appreciate that. Yeah. So, you know, one of the things about P. Frank, which I don't think a lot of people know, is that behind the scenes, he was doing a lot of stuff on BET, and he was very intentional about involving folks, especially from the Bay, when they were doing the American Gangster series, of course, doing Unsung. And every time I seen P. Frank, he was always like, always trying to get a social justice angle. So that's one thing I know about him. But the real history, which I think we don't talk about, is your stints with The Source and being an editor. And then even before that, being, you know, a regular beat reporter and writer for the L.A. Times. So you've been doing this for a minute. And how have you seen the changing landscape from the day that you were, you know, writing for the Times and up to now?
There's been a general dumbing down of society. In general, you know, I graduated from Columbia Journalism School, and I worked at the LA Times for 7 years, and I wrote real stories. So I actually had to go out and talk to people and put it together and have a real point of view and be thoughtful. And I think in the age of Donald Trump and TMZ, you know, these quick bites of information, and, you know, my daughter, who's 13, is, like, addicted to this thing, and her whole perception about what's real and not real is based on that. And as a person who was a real journalist, you know, I don't want to say whatever, but, you know, and has actually been in the newsroom as a reporter at LA Times and, you know, editor of Source magazine. And we, even at The Source, it was a music magazine, but we had a cultural, political point of view, and we were trying to be about something of substance. And I think in general, you know, it's funny, I think the last time I was in Oakland, I mentioned that I was doing a show, and it's currently about to go, and it's about a deep topic. But part of the problem of getting it to production was I had to go get a celebrity executive producer. And they were fighting me about the talent that they wanted on there, and a certain amount of music stars and other people that, before they would give me the money to do whatever, that was a part of the game. So I'm saying, for me being a reporter in 95, when I, you know, or when I covered OJ standing outside on a ladder, or being, you know, some serious reporting, Now they're like, what celebrity is in it so that I can put it in the promo and get more money? And so, you know, I don't think it's a good thing. The only thing that
what do you think attributes that change where you had to have the celebrity? And I've dealt with that doing documentaries. I remember one documentary that we were set to put out. You may remember. I'll give you the name afterwards. But it was ready to go. And when they went to the distributor, they was like, we don't know who Jim Brown is. We don't know who Angela Davis is. And they gave us a list. It's like, you better put Ja Rule, 50 Cent. And they went down the list. And otherwise, it wasn't going to get distributed, you know. And this was a major, major thing. So when do you see the change, and what do you attribute it to, Frank?
I would say, obviously, in the early 2000s, I think the death of print, you know, the source. Take, for example, you know, if I wrote an article about Scarface or about Pac or whoever, or Lauryn Hill in 98, it would take you a month and a half when you got that information, and Lauryn wouldn't have an opportunity to tweet and hit you back. There was a wall. A separation between celebrity and real life. So to get to that celebrity, they couldn't be drunk, like, you know, rest in peace, Mac Miller, go on the internet and be high as hell. Their manager, the publisher, stopped that. So I think around the 2000s, and a lot of journalism newspapers started to die, and real thoughtfulness has been gone. And, you know, I've worked with TMZ, and I see the necessity of that, because I do think that they do a certain amount of news journalism, but also salaciousness. And you got to ask yourself, too, you know, as a media person, I think one of the biggest problems in the country right now is that the media is covering the circus of Donald Trump, but they're not covering the substance of what's been happening. And it's just embarrassing. I have a really good friend who works at MSNBC. And, you know, he was ecstatic last year. He got a hell of a bonus. Their ratings are up like 40% because all of the circus that happens with him is making them money. Does that mean that they're actually covering him? The bomb, you know, when I saw President Barack Obama go in yesterday, the day before, he finally said it. I'm like, I know you, but he couldn't say it because of the politics around it. We live in a country where you truth telling is just, it's just deep. You know, as a person who's given my life, grew up as a child of the Black Panther Party and some here in the building, you know, we're here to advocate, as a brother said, to make our communities better. But I think in general, people want to be lit and pop bottles and, you know, see what Cardi B did to Nicki Minaj versus trying to do something powerful.
So let me ask you this, and then we'll switch into the other topic. How were you able to get some of the subject matter that you wanted to pass some of these gatekeepers? So, for example, when you were doing the stuff at BET, you were doing the American Gangster series, and then you finally went in and you did one of the gangsters was J. Edgar Hoover. How did you sell that? Yeah. So they did a whole thing where it was Nicky Barnes, it was like Frank Lucas, and then they went and you know, just like, you know, American Gangster, J. Edgar Hoover. So you were able to do that. And then, you know, there were other things that you were able to put in there, you know, COINTELPRO and things like that, and some of the unsungs. How have you been able to sell that, knowing that folks may want something a little bit more salacious?
Well, no, I think, you know, I'm a father. I have children. And so it's like they don't necessarily want to eat vegetables, but you got to try to give them some vegetables while you give them some entertainment. You know, my life is definitely about balancing entertainment with fact. The fact that I did Matul Shakur, American Gangster, the reason why it really sold.
That's right, you had Matulu.
Yeah,
right.
And so Matulu was because Tupac was his stepson. So that I sold you the father of Tupac, but then I dropped all these other jewels when he was with, you know, all these Black militant groups and what he did and expropriation and, you know, Assad and all that. So I think that it's just the unfortunate part that my job now is sort of trickery, obviously, to put some deep stuff with you, but you got to sprinkle it with some celebrity. That's just no way. It ain't going down unless you do that.
But the last
on
show,
a major Viacom network stuff that I do, I'm super recognizant of the booking. I just did a show right now where the mayor of Atlanta was in it, but I made sure T.I. was in it. I put Rashida from Love & Hip Hop on there because I knew that she had a celebrity following. I put her in the beginning of the show because I knew that women would want it. I put her in the promo, and I put a clip of Love & Hip Hop in there just on purpose to get the attention of the people. You have to adopt. You know, Madonna say, you got to keep going. So believe me, it's at the front of my brain. If I put a, you know, J. Cole in there so you could get all head bob, and then I drop, you know, Bobby Seale right after that, then, you know.
The last show on that American Gangster series was the J. Edgar Hoover's The Gangster. Did you know that was happening before, or did they make the call after
Last show? I think that we got into a place with the show, with American Gangster at least, where we gave you enough entertainment that you could slip in a couple of those. You know what I mean? That was just deep. You know what I mean? But you can't do a lot of deep stuff. I mean, I wish I could do deep TV and movies, but it don't work like that no more. That game is over. It has to be some entertainment in it, or it's not popping. You know, I think Netflix is giving you an opportunity, other big streaming, where you don't necessarily have to do that. But generally speaking, Viacom, you know, BET, VH1, you got to have some entertainment.
Ha ha ha!
This is the Berkeley Signal.
Where did you go? There's good news.
It's time again for Donald
Trump.
Theater.
No one knows what's up or down.
Black
or white.
Legal
or
impeachable.
Everything is make-believe in Donald
Trump.
Theater.
So let's
pull
the
curtain
back.
We are controlling transmission. If we wish to make it louder, we will bring up the volume. We can change the focus to a soft blur.
You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into...
The things that this show has called him, this approach is, I guess it's kind of like we're living in the Twilight Zone.
Russia had nothing to do with this episode.
Truth isn't truth.
This is a day of national consecration. And I am certain that on this day, my fellow Americans, I will address them with a candor and a decision which the present situation of our people impels. So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
When you grow up, do you want to be the president? Well, this book shows that anybody can do it. It's called Fear by Bob Woodward. In it, an ogre made of cheese runs the country without knowing anything about how to do it. It's scary and funny and sad all at the same time.
My favorite part was watching the Republic crumble before our eyes.
I like the part where the president ordered the assassination of Bashar al-Assad, but then his generals ignored him.
Don't read it before bed. You'll get nightmares.
And don't read it in the day because you'll get daymares.
What makes you afraid?
Afraid?
Well, what fills you with fear?
The first is not knowing, and that's what we've got to do. We need to know what's going on.
How will we know what's going on? Because the hallmark of Trump's behavior in this book is from day to day, he may or may not remember what his idea was yesterday.
Yes, yeah, that's true, and that's part of the problem.
And you also say the very last line of the book, not to interrupt you, but the very last line of the book, not to give it away, it's worth reading the entire thing, I promise you.
It has the F word.
It has the F word here.
Yes,
this is Dowd, his lawyer, talking about the president.
Right,
he says,
right at the end, after they practiced a session in the
Mueller.
White House, and, you know, and the lawyer acts like he's Mueller and he asks the questions of Trump.
Yep.
And Trump goes ballistic, makes things up, starts screaming. Dowd thought if he'd been Mueller, he would have been fired right on the spot.
Right.
And
he says, Mr. President, you know, either you do this my way or you're going to be fitted for an orange jumpsuit.
Yes. And you can't testify. You are disabled. I mean, imagine your lawyer telling you're disabled.
Right.
And you can't testify because... you can't tell the truth. You just make things up.
And I'll say it because I don't have the credibility you do. Dowd knew he could not bring himself to say to the president, you're a liar. And that's how you end the book.
Yeah.
I think you buried the lead.
And I would have loved to have spoken to you. You know I'm very open to you. I think you've always been fair.
Quote, the Woodward book is a joke. Just another assault against me in a barrage of assaults using now disproven, unnamed, and anonymous sources. Many have already come forward to say the quotes by them, like the book, are fiction. Dems can't stand losing. I'll write the real book.
And I would have loved to have spoken to you. You know I'm very open to you. I think you've always been fair.
You look at the president's Twitter feed, it doesn't seem to be under control. He's clearly rattled and agitated by Bob Woodward's reporting in the book. He wants people to believe it's a fiction, but then the White House also wants people to believe that this is just griping from disgruntled former staffers, so it can't be both.
Trump's closest aides have resorted to hiding documents from him to stop him from signing or reading them.
Woodward describes an administrative coup d'etat
and a nervous breakdown of the executive branch, with senior aides conspiring to pluck official papers from the president's desk so he couldn't see or even sign them.
Woodward also details the actions of some top aides in the White House, including former economic advisor Goldman Sachs veteran Gary Cohn. Quote, according to Woodward, Cohn stole a letter off Trump's desk that the president was intending to sign to formally withdraw the U.S. from a trade agreement with South Korea.
Porter consulted Cohn, Gary Cohn, who told him, according to Woodward, quote, I can stop this. I'll just take the paper off his desk.
The president and his team are going after Bob Woodward and his new book, Fear.
How do you feel when the president says you're lying?
I'm not. What is the contest in America other than the political contest? It's a contest for the truth. What is the truth? And I'm willing to put myself out here. I've done the work. This is the best reporting you can do, or that I can do.
And when you're talking about a credibility face-off and the truth emerging, we want to ask who's more reliable, the reporter who broke Watergate, where that truth eventually did emerge, or the man the Washington Post says has made more than 4,713 false or misleading claims since he was sworn into office. By the way, that's an average of 8 claims a day.
The book is selling very, very well. A spokesperson for Simon & Schuster said, we've reprinted 6 times for a total of 7 reprints to meet extraordinary demand. It'll put 1 million books in print before we've even gone on sale. And it's all thanks to the tireless and nonstop work of their social media marketing whiz, Donald J. Trump, who does nothing but talk about it. Trump, of course, claims the book is a work of fiction, like climate change and marriage and things like that. But Woodward stands by his reporting. He claims a key member of the Trump administration told him the stuff he put in the book was 1,000% true. Gee, I wonder which key member of the administration would use a phrase like that.
We're behind you 1,000%.
We will support Israel 1,000%.
You had a rough bout, and now you're 1,000%.
I am with you 1,000%.
We're with you 1,000%.
Well, she's heard it before. This is just the latest in a series of books about the Trump presidency. They all have similar titles. The first book was Fire and Fury by Michael Wolff, and then came Unhinged by Omarosa. This one is called Fear by Bob Woodward, and this is only the beginning. At this point, there are more books about Trump than there are about hobbits. Some of the the new ones on the way, coming next month, Nutjob, Insane Clown POTUS, and all the president's mental problems. That one is 900 pages long.
Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance.
It's pretty disgusting. That's pretty sad. Perhaps it's a disgruntled person who's been thrown out because they didn't deliver on what they were supposed to do. Listen, I think you're subverting the will of the people. I mean, to try to control the presidency while not the president. You have millions and millions of Americans who voted for this. I think there are people in there that he can trust. It's just, it's a much smaller group than I would like it to be.
Who do you trust?
Well, I'll keep that to myself.
And they're not family?
Well, obviously, yeah, I'm talking outside of family. Okay. I think that one goes without saying.
Are you scared that you could go to jail?
I'm not, because I know what I did, and I'm not worried about any of that. You know, that doesn't mean they won't try to create something. I mean, we've seen that happen with everything. But, again, I'm not.
The president spent his day in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, draining the swamp, no doubt, while all manner of hell continues to break loose back in Washington, D.C. But it was good for him. He needed to get out of the office. He was in Billings, Montana last night, with the latest stop on his violent torpedo of untruth tour. And while there, he continued to try to discredit the savage anonymous op-ed that was written by a member of his own administration and published in the New York Times. Someone on the inside, who it was, he still doesn't know, but it would appear, based on some of the things he said in his speech, that he is closing in.
The latest act of resistance is the op-ed published in the failing New York Times by an anonymous, really an anonymous, gutless coward. An anonymous. An anonymous.
An anomalous. And then started boxing.
Yeah. This is one of the most surreal aspects of the moment we're in. The President of the United States regularly has to go on TV and try to convince people that he's not out of his mind. In fact, last week, he just straight up asked his supporters to tell him that he's good at his job.
I beat all these senators, all these governors, all these brilliant political minds. Then I beat the other side. And then I listen, is he competent? I think I'm pretty competent, right? Don't you think so?
On Wednesday, an unnamed senior White House official wrote an op-ed in the Times claiming that Trump's actions are detrimental to the health of our republic. Trump immediately pushed back, tweeting, treason!
We are learning from Bob Woodward's new book that a tweet the president almost set, some worried, could have prompted a war.
He drafts a tweet saying we are going to pull out dependents from South Korea, family members of the 28,000 people there. At that moment, there was a sense of profound alarm in the Pentagon leadership that, my God, one tweet, and we have reliable information that the North Koreans are going to read this as an attack is imminent.
Kim Jong-un of North Korea proclaims unwavering faith in President Trump. Thank you to Chairman King. We will get it done together.
Trump even bragged about his relationship with Kim Jong-un last night, which is so crazy. I think we forget how crazy it is that he's in front of a crowd in Montana talking about his buddy Kim Jong-un, and people are cheering this. He said, I respect him, and he respects me. Of course, no Trump rally would be complete without him comparing himself to Abraham Lincoln.
You know, when Abraham Lincoln made the Gettysburg Address speech, the great speech, do you know he was ridiculed? He was ridiculed.
Not at all true, by the way. He was not ridiculed. In fact, Kellyanne Conway's husband, who to me might be the most interesting man in the world, immediately tweeted evidence that he was wrong about that, that he was not ridiculed. But the truth isn't necessarily the truth, so go on.
50 years after his death, they said it may have been the greatest speech ever made in America. Pretty good. Pretty good. I have a feeling that's going to happen with us.
47 years ago, that's when this country was really fantastic. That I can tell you. Now we've got all these Irishmen and Italians sneaking across the ocean and stealing our jobs, eating our mutton, And it is a bigly problem, believe me. Huge. And my haters don't even have the courage to criticize me to my face. They prefer to remain anonymous. Anonymous. Boy, I need this word like I need a hole in the head. Anyway, let's make America great again. You're all mentally retarded.
It's tremendously big and tremendously wet.
There is a secret group of senior officials in the White House who say they are trying to stop Trump from being Trump. That's right. They're taking him down from the inside.
Inside job. New fallout this morning from that explosive New York Times op-ed.
It is rattling the White House and the finger pointing is on.
No surprise, Trump is furious, calling on the New York Times to turn the writer over to the government.
Inside the West Wing, there really is this intensifying sense of betrayal. White House staffers don't know who they can trust. The president doesn't know who's loyal to him and who's out to get him.
The obsession inside the White House, the hunt for the anonymous op-ed writer who claims to be the resistance inside the administration. President Trump now calling on U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions to investigate, and a source tells CNN aides believe they are closing in on exposing the writer.
The president has become obsessed with finding the leaker, and we know this because of another leaker who leaked that Trump said, "We got to get rid of them. The snakes are everywhere, but we're getting rid of them." But if you're surrounded by snakes, Mr. President, you've only got yourself to blame. You hired them. And if you find out who they are, I think I know what they're going to say.
You knew damn well I was a snake before you took me in.
Well, the effort is still underway at the White House to root out the senior administration official who penned this op-ed in the New York Times, which really does not portray the president in a positive light. It portrays the president as somebody who makes reckless decisions, whose impulses must be constantly checked by the advisors around him. And the White House is still trying to figure out who this person is. A source close to the White House telling CNN the list has been whittled down to just a few people.
Very quiet. I'm hunting
Lakers.
Kill the
Lakers.
Kill the
Lakers.
Kill the
Lakers.
Kill the
Lakers.
I'll kill the
Lakers.
Strike lightning! Strike the
Lakers.
What have I done? I've killed the
Lakers.
Poor widow
Lakers.
Poor widow
Lakers.
Now, the person who did this is someone who thinks that Trump is amoral and unfit to be president. That's who we're looking for. So that narrows it down to everybody.
So now Trump's White House is engaged in an aggressive attempt to hunt down and expose the leakers in his government who think he's out of his mind, and they've reportedly considered some extreme measures.
Advisors to the president are considering all their options, including the idea of a lie detector test.
You want Trump staffers to take lie detector tests? Bringing a lie detector test inside this White House is like bringing a Geiger counter to Chernobyl. All right, let's start with you, Kellyanne. Let's start with you, John Kelly. Yeah, you know what? Let's just start with the president. We have a paranoid president who's demanding investigations of his critics. If you're looking for the constitutional crisis, it's here, and it's being aided and abetted by people whose names we don't even know. People who are...
anonymous.
What happened to the Republican Party? How hard can that be? Saying that Nazis are bad.
One person was not soothed by Obama's lilting cadence, Donald Trump, who addressed his predecessor's performance at another one of his rallies.
I watched it, but I fell asleep. I found he's very good for sleeping.
He's right. When Obama was president, I could actually sleep at night. Trump feels surrounded by traitors at this point. It's no wonder that one of Trump's friends said that he fretted after Wednesday's op-ed that he could trust only his children.
To those who believe that this man is a fool, that this man is crazy, that there's something wrong with Donald Trump and it's just the people around him that keep us safe, you don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. If you're out there saying Trump's a kook or he's crazy or he's unfit for office, you don't know what you're talking about.
I think he's a kook.
I think he's crazy. I think he's unfit for office.
Even as a parade of Trump officials quietly warn the public that he's unfit for office, they're letting him hang around to fill a lifetime seat on the Supreme Court with his handpicked nominee, Brett Kavanaugh. And in his confirmation hearing so far, Kavanaugh has been exactly the kind of loyal partisan Trump would want. For example, he's been asked a series of questions that could be crucial to the Russia investigation, like, can the president pardon himself? Does he have to comply with a subpoena? And every time, he has refused to answer even those basic questions.
President Trump claims he has an absolute right to pardon himself. Does he?
The question of self-pardons is something I've never analyzed.
Can a sitting president be required to respond to a subpoena?
So that's a hypothetical question.
No, it's not. The president's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, is on TV every day talking about how Trump would just ignore a subpoena. Now, Trump has denied all of this, and yesterday in the Oval Office, he called Woodward's book a work of fiction. But that's not what he told Woodward on the phone when he called him just a few weeks ago to complain that he hadn't been interviewed for the book. Woodward recorded the call, and Trump was very complimentary.
I spent a lot of time on this, talked to lots of people.
All right, good.
And as you know and are living, we're at a pivot point in history.
Right.
And I would have liked to have done that, and I maximized my effort.
Right.
And somehow it didn't get to you. Or
it's really too bad because nobody told me about it, and I would have loved to have spoken to you. You know I'm very open to you. I think you've always been fair.
Oh, my God. How is there always a secret tape that contradicts everything Trump says? Although I guess I shouldn't be surprised the same guy who can be tricked into not signing a piece of paper doesn't realize everyone around him has a GoPro strapped to their heads. But hey, in fairness to Trump, he probably didn't know he was being recorded.
I'm turning on my tape recorder.
Oh, that's
with
okay.
Your permission.
That's okay.
Oh, my God. He's like a... He's like a bank robber who waves at the security camera. The craziest part of this phone call is when Trump explains that his aides never asked him if he wanted to do an interview with Woodward because they were too afraid.
It's a chance missed, and I don't know how things work over there in terms
very well.
Of getting to you.
Well, if you would call Madeline in my office, did you speak to Madeline?
No, I didn't. But
Madeline is the key. She's the secret
well,
because she's,
to Raj
she's
about
the
it.
Person.
I talked to Kelly.
Well, a lot of them are afraid to come and talk, but you never called for me. It would have been nice, Bob, if
well,
you called
I
for me in my office. I mean, I have a secretary. I have two, three secretaries. If you would have called directly, a lot of people are afraid.
So to recap, Trump says Bob Woodward's book is a work of fiction because he never spoke to Woodward because his aides were too afraid to talk to him about doing an interview for Woodward's book, which is literally called Fear. Trump is such a bad liar, even his lies prove that he's lying. Your book called Fear is totally inaccurate, and I would have told you that if my aides weren't too afraid to come talk to me.
Dude, song's over. Hey. All right. Cool. This is K-Bong. K-B-O-N-G Radio here at the University of Budington. And where was I? Oh, yeah, Bud U, yeah. And we're going to have some more music now. Cool. Yeah. I think, who's this? Swamo, I think. Yeah. And on Bud. K-Bong.
Happy hardcore mode!
CNN.
Okay, this is a brand new song about a girl I'm in love with. I'm really sorry to all the girls who send me letters and tell me that they're loving me, but I got somebody else that I'm in love with now, so I wrote a song about her. This is exactly how it goes. Okay, you ready to listen to it? All right, here we go. Okay, here it comes. Let me tell you about a girl and I love her so.
Naughty Pirates from Turgid Pictures, rated R.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
From Berkeley, it's TwitWit Radio.
Are you medicated?
I would rather be sedated. I would rather be sedated. I frighten easily. The terrorist might, they might release a biotoxin like that guy at Fort Dietrich. He was a member of my church. Bruce Ivins worked at the bioweapons lab and commits suicide with an overdose of Tylenol because he refused to admit that he sent anthrax to members of Congress who don't want the Patriot Act.
I mean, why would anybody trust what they read in the New York Times?
The New York Times is true 90% of the time, if you don't count the front page.
Do you know for certain that Bruce Ivins was a patsy? I mean, well, was he? Was he murdered?
He looked like a nice man, but do nice people send weaponized anthrax to members of Congress?
Bruce Ivins seemed like a nice guy. I mean, he did church work, didn't he? He was in charge of making a vaccine for anthrax, and the government says he did it, so there you are, case closed. But Bruce Ivins didn't make weaponized anthrax. That required skills and equipment that Bruce Ivins did not possess. But look, somebody has to be blamed for it, or the case would be open, and a new investigation might lead to the lab where anthrax was weaponized. And there is a treaty making it illegal to do that.
Excuse me, but I would like to address the panel on the side of an envelope and mail you to Cuba.
Nobody wants to know what's happening. Go back to sleep. A nice man is going to take care of everything for you. So nighty, nighty, night. Sleep tight. It's going to be a bumpy flight.
I would rather be sedated, but I have a feeling that everything will be okay.
Sedated into a bemused numbness. A sleepy time, dream time of celebrities and terror and false narratives advancing lies too enormous to comprehend.
Also, there are some announcements that I would like to make, but I have a few extra Paxils if anybody needs one.
If there really was a mass sedation, don't you think we would have done something to stop it by now? Huh?
Imagine what would happen if a real opposition party were to govern this country from as far to the left as the Republicans have governed from the right. I mean, we would not be making wars in Afghanistan. We would have children who would continue to develop critical thinking skills. Imagine
I don't
what would
need
happen.
Critical thinking skills. I need Wi-Fi access directly into my brain.
Well, that's your opinion, not mine.
If you were in my shoes, you would do the same thing that I'm doing. And that requires crowd control. Pharmaceuticals are an excellent way to control crowds.
Do you think it might be possible for me to have my change administered anally?
Like it or not.
This is TwitWit Radio, half true, more or less 100% of the time. I'm Berkeley Kidd. In this episode, CIA spies running for Congress and the stupid 5G smart grid. Are we ready?
Bad day.
Go ahead, dude.
Uh-huh. Let's go.
Without objection, round one.
For 100 points, give a misleading answer to this question. Which comes first, tyranny or submission? Now, think carefully.
I should know this one.
Which comes first?
Tyranny or submission?
Submission?
Wrong.
Tyranny.
Wronger. One more.
Dang it. My buzzer's broken.
Swing voter takes the lead.
Wait a second.
Boo, yay. This is exciting. I never win anything.
Taking the lead does not mean that you have won, dear. My faction, Safe KPFA, controls this board. To the victor go the spoils. If Safe KPFA is reelected, the members can expect an attractive suitor.
Define suitor.
Suitor, one who petitions or entreats a party to a lawsuit, one who seeks to marry, one who seeks to take over a business.
Is Bill Moyers one of your suitors?
Bill Moyers is a big flirt.
Bill Moyers is PBS and NPR.
As chair, it is a policy to increase listeners by sounding less distinctive, to be more like other stations, especially in the morning when the commute is so stressful. I don't want to hear how the new 5G smart grid might be weaponized to increase the suicidal death spiral among child laborers forced to work in a smartphone assembly plant in China because a little girl factory worker under 12 had small enough fingers to be hired at the Apple Watch factory in South China. For friggin' sake. Item one, local board elections. Can we really afford to have elections with such a late start and the Discord thing?
What is your policy on Discord?
I support the troops, but I oppose board elections if we can delay the plan until after a bankruptcy judge has been appointed.
How do you do that without violating the bylaws?
As a temporary measure, yes, just because.
What are you trying to accomplish?
Do you want another 9/11?
Do you?
I am not a 9/11 denier.
Do you deny that a nice man named Bruce Ivins mailed weaponized anthrax to members of Congress and the press?
Nice people do not send weaponized anthrax through the mail to the press and members of Congress.
Bruce Evans was suicided to close the investigation.
I suppose you believe that the dead Kennedys were assassinated by a gang of lone gunmen.
And you know it's true.
Oh, no one believes the magic bullet theory. But that's what happened.
What happened?
There was a faction fight in the presidential motorcade in Dallas. Big deal. Many people get killed by gunshots every day. What does it matter if two of them were named Kennedy?
Political assassination is just politics. Apathy in the face of tyranny is interpreted as public consent.
Not my consent.
You have a smart meter on your home, don't you?
I did not give my consent to put that stupid smart meter on my home.
Did anyone ask for your consent?
I would have said no.
So you weren't asked, and a smart meter was installed there. Mass surveillance is a wonderful thing.
Oh, the public loves surveillance, especially self-surveillance. I do it all day long.
Yes, the public wants to be spied on. It makes them feel important, as if they mattered.
Nobody needs to know what I had for dinner last night.
You had a prefeast meal at Chez Panisse with wine and dessert. $457 with tax and a tip.
No, the tip was included. It was a lovely dinner. Bill Moyers turned my offer down, but I'm going to appoint him to the board anyway.
You can't appoint board members. We have elections. This is listener democracy.
The new bylaws will allow the board to self-appoint future board members.
The membership will block you.
How can there be a membership to block anything if elections are delayed through no fault of my own?
Apathy in the face of tyranny is implied consent.
Are the subscribers always in the dark?
The listeners think they know what they want to listen to, but the secret program council knows better. Professionals in data analysis can utilize the new 5G network to maximize pledge drive donations according to individual fears and your anxiety profile.
You have a right to waive your privacy rights.
If you have nothing to hide, why are you worried about surveillance?
Surveillance is as American as Apple. as American as the Apple Watch.
If you get declared a cast iron target, that means they're going to go specifically at you for everything and manually review what you are doing, what you are saying, or any actions or movements you're making. So you will be specifically looked at by people, and not just processes, but by people. So it's a greater degree of focus of an intelligence effort against you and everything you do. They took away any protections that anybody had, U.S. citizen or otherwise. So there were no protections at all then for anybody.
The voice is NSA whistleblower Bill Binney. We have a special announcement.
The 14th annual 9/11 Truth Film Festival opens at the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland, California, Tuesday, September 11th, from 3 p.m. to 11 p.m., hosted by Bonnie Faulkner and Peter B. Collins.
No one turned away for lack of funds.
Do we really need another 9/11 film festival?
Why would anyone want another 9/11 film festival?
Another attack would be a valuable lesson.
What lesson?
A vigorous police state is not enough to prevent another surprise attack. We also need better surveillance and thought controls.
The 5G network is being rolled out now. It will connect your brain tissue to all your devices.
I have a question.
The facilitator has a question.
Go ahead.
Do you know what I dreamt about last night?
You dreamt that your mother was dancing with a giant soda can.
How do you know that?
Pepsi paid for that dream. The 5G network makes dreaming better.
Who are you?
I'm the campaign advisor for Safe KPFA.
And what do you advise?
Delay the board elections and file for voluntary bankruptcy.
Caller on line 3.
Go ahead, caller.
Can you name one false flag operation that didn't really happen?
The Gulf of Tonkin incident never happened. It escalated the Vietnam War, the sinking of the Maine. It started the Spanish-American War, and the unreal WMD started the war in Iraq. The King David Hotel, the Bologna State train station bombing, the Weather Underground bombings.
Patty Hearst and the Symbionese Liberation Army.
And Building 7.
No comment.
Osama didn't do it, dude.
No way. Osama didn't do it. Was never in the loop.
Everybody knows all that.
Yeah, what about the anthrax attacks?
Osama didn't do it is a fiction.
Well, I already know that.
Is there anything Zuckerberg hasn't told you?
How to delete my search history when I close my account.
Zuckerberg is just a beard.
A beard?
A front. Agent Zuckerberg is one of ours.
Who isn't one of yours?
5G is here unless you stop it, and you won't.
A sabotage is always an option.
Caller on line 1.
Go ahead, caller.
That's what people need to do. Call these criminals out for what they are. This is one big, happy criminal family running this world because we don't call it. You know, we get all this national rubbish in the way, think it's about England or it's about America or it's about China or it's about Russia or whatever. They all work together, folks. They're using the facial recognition glasses in China now. They're using social crediting in China now. They won't put, you know, 53 cents towards the rollout of blankets for the homeless. But they'll make sure that every 8 houses in 10 has to have a smart meter on their home because they need that. They need the surveillance system in place. They want to be able to track everything and everybody and everything everybody does. And we can't let them do this because this is the end game. This is what it's been about all along. It's all been about this whole smart grid all along. It's all been leading to this point. And the only way we're going to defeat this system is to realize that the world's run by criminals, and we can call them that because that's what they are. Your government is a terrorist. And this whole system is based on social terrorism, everything. The education system, the whole fear-based system that we've got, anything that we are required to do under fear of punishment, this is terrorism by definition. And this whole system is based on it. You know, it's ingrained into us since childbirth. It's ingrained into us through the scholastic system, through everything that we do. Now, we don't do anything because we want to do it, because we want to learn, because we want to be a better person. We do it because we're afraid to do otherwise, because we'll get punished if we think outside the box. And it's about to be taken to the next level with this smart system. This is going to curtail all form of human expression completely. Now, you won't be able to think anything or create anything or do anything that the government doesn't approve of, and that is no way to live a life. And we can't allow it to happen. So we have to factor into everything the reality that the world is run by criminals, and that is what has caused this problem. And it's going to continue until we name that for what they are. And you're a criminal. We don't have to do what you say. You're in abusive office, and we want you charged. We want you pulled down and charged for your crimes because you're a criminal. Not even the fact that you're supporting the war crimes of Israel. You want to go and bomb children in Syria because of this gas attack. You know, you think the solution is killing more people. You know, you're a warmongering liar. You're an abusive office. You're inflicting legislation upon us that we don't want, bringing in a smart system we don't want. This is not what we employ you to do. Go away.
That was Agnes Obel and Max Egan. I have a tweet here that says the CIA is secretly running intelligence agents for Congress in the 2018 midterms.
Why is no one talking about this?
It can't be talked about in public. It has to be done in secret because that's the way it has always been done.
Which CIA candidates running for Congress are favored to win?
I want a straight answer.
I'm going to rule against that.
On what grounds?
Undercover agents do not reveal their methods and procedures when bringing democracy and peace to the world by secretly running for Congress in the midterm elections.
Roll the clip.
Intelligence agents running for office isn't anything new. George Bush Sr. was a CIA agent and even later served as the director of the CIA. Before riding Reagan's coattails into the White House. And of course, as we all know, Bush, after becoming vice president, weeks after Reagan was sworn in, a friend of the Bushes tried to assassinate him, which would have given the ruling class the president they really wanted, the ex-CIA director, George Bush. So forgive me if I'm a little bit suspicious of CIA operatives running for office, which there seems to be an awful lot of in the 2018 midterm elections. One quarter of the candidates running of the 102 districts that the DNC feel they have a fighting chance are intelligence agency operatives. So to put this into perspective, out of all the candidates running, 57 have military intelligence or State Department or NSC backgrounds. Military intelligence candidates account for 10 of the 22 districts selected for the most high-profile attention as part of the Red to Blue program. So nearly half of the candidates the DNC will be throwing money at are deep state spies. So, there you have it. Maybe that's why the DNC is always able to evade prosecution or even investigation from the deep state. The deep state that grew exponentially under Bush and then was allowed to run amok under Obama is now running for office. And the worst part is, some of them, at least, are going to win.
You are listening to Twit Wit Radio, half true, more or less 100% of the time.
Will someone please define peace?
Siri, define peace.
Peace. A world with no opposing forces strong enough to throw the crooks out.
I take exception to that word. Though I sometimes do crooked things, I am not a crook.
I have my doubts.
Why should the members of this radio station vote for you or your faction in the board elections?
I have worked hard all my life. I sit on many boards. I don't have time to divide and conquer them all. I'm doing what I can to crash the finances against a sympathetic bankruptcy judge.
I don't trust your faction. Safe KPFA lost $3 million in CPB funding for not submitting yearly audits.
Why did you cancel guns and butter?
I am not responsible for members of my faction who serve on the Secret Program Council. Guns and butter should have been banned from this network years ago.
Without due process? Why?
Vaccination denial is anti-Semitism.
Bill Binney on line two.
The CIA has been working for decades, since about the 1950s, to penetrate the news media, publications, magazines, anything. Even from The Intercept, they'll send a copy off to NSA or CIA or FBI or whatever, whichever agency it involves, and say, "We're getting ready to publish this. What do you have in it? What are your comments?" And then they'll come back and say, "Well, we'd like you to change this, redact that, or something." You know, and they'll do it. Even from The Intercept, with the Russiagate, they're fabricating a story. In fact, one of the former CIA directors said, "We'll know when our propaganda program has succeeded when everything that everyone in the country believes is false." That came from the mouth of one of the, Casey, I think, Jay Casey, the former director of CIA.
When I control a majority of seats on the board, we'll have peace. When the crazies are gone, all the faction fighting won't be necessary to stir the pot, because my enemies will hopefully all be gone, or at least purged. If we do not elect the best people and those damn grassroots activists win a majority, they'll demand a program council. And can you imagine the consequences if listeners decided what goes on the air? Ah.
Disgruntled listener on line two.
Go ahead, disgruntled listener.
Hello? Am I on the air?
Oh, turn down your radio. That hurt my ears. Do you have anything positive to say?
I want to host a Sunday morning radio show called School Sucks. Can I interview you?
I don't like the title. School Sucks is unnecessarily aggressive. Are you a boy? Would you consider a call-in show about toxic masculinity in preteens in middle school?
I'm unschooled. Are you opposed to unschooling?
Whose interview is this? I do not answer questions from unschooled children with precocious attitudes who oppose the Common Core curriculum.
Are you a Common Core controller?
I follow best practices.
Are you trying to manipulate my mind?
I am. I do not accept anything that comes from a non-receptive, unschooled mind, with one exception. Unschooled hive minds are acceptable in the phone room. Now, hold hands and visualize something very specific.
Can you be more specific?
I can, yes. Visualize a can of green peas.
Don't do it.
It's just a can of peas, damn it.
I'm sorry, but I don't visualize color.
What is wrong with you?
I can visualize some fresh picked black-eyed peas.
Is that a motion?
No, the motion has not been seconded.
Second.
I call the question.
If you vote yes, the motion passes. If you vote no, the motion passes.
Do you have a problem with that?
All we're saying is give peas a chance.
I wasn't taught how to get a job, but I can remember dissecting a frog. I wasn't taught how to pay tax, but I know loads about Shakespeare's classics. I was never taught how to vote. They devoted that time to defining isotopes. I wasn't taught how to look after my health, but mitochondria is the powerhouse of the cell. Never spent a lesson on current events.
Instead, I studied the old American West. I was never taught what laws there are. I was never taught what laws there are. Let me repeat. I was not taught the laws for the country I live in. But I know how Henry VIII killed his women. Divorced, beheaded, died. Divorced, beheaded, survived. Glad that's in my head instead of financial advice. I was shown the wavelengths of different hues of light. But I was never taught my human rights. Apparently there's 30. Do you know them? I don't. Why the hell can't we both recite them? By won't I know? Igneous, metamorphic, and sedimentary rocks. Yet I don't know squat about trading stocks or how money works at all. Where does it come from? How does the thing that motivates the world function? Not taught to budget and disperse my earnings. I was too busy there rehearsing cursive. Didn't learn how much it costs to raise a kid or what an affidavit is. But I spent days on what the quadratic equation is. Negative b plus or minus the square root of b squared minus 4ac over 2a. That's insane. That's absolutely insane. They maybe learn that over basic first aid or how to recognize
the music is Boy in a Band. Who's on the line?
Ivanka Incorporated. I'm raising my offer to $200 million. Take it or leave it.
The subscribers won't approve it.
Each subscriber can receive a share of the purchase price. Are you a subscriber?
I need to consult with my calculator. Suri, what is $200 million divided by tens of thousands subscribers?
Each subscriber receives 2,805.57¢.
Uh-oh. I can't remember if I renewed my subscription.
Donate $25 today to become a member and share $200 million tomorrow.
Ivanka's trying to corrupt the membership.
Number one, the network is priceless. Number two, it's not for sale.
The membership decides that, not you.
I think we should hold out for more.
We can't afford not to accept this offer.
Who is going to expose government lies if we lose the network?
Community radio is so boring. After the sale is finalized, there are going to be some program changes.
What program changes?
Steve Bannon is going to replace Amy Goodman, and a Sunday morning children's show will be hosted by Jeffrey Epstein.
You can submit a program proposal to program committee.
There is no program committee.
Exactly.
Oh, can you tell us something about your program ideas?
There will be animal sacrifices and spirit cooking.
Spirit cooking? So you really are a Democrat.
From the floor of the Senate saloon, the comedian of the United States.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Speaker. Yes, thank you. Thank you. Mr. Speaker, members of the House, members of the Cabinet, ladies and chumps, it is with great pride that I stand up before you do and come to the podium to deliver the annual State of the Humor Address. And I am happy to report that this has been one of the funniest years to date. Reports from those of you who have been dating reaffirm that laughter remains the most fun you can have with your clothes on. The amount of clothing to be worn while laughing is optional and shall remain so as long as I am comedian of these United States of America. Thank you. Thank you so very much. A long time ago, she was a virgin land. She offered her honor. We honored her offer. And for the last 200 years, it's been honor and offer. I am proud to report that the New Yuck Joke Exchange is at its highest volume in more than a decade, with more than 12 million, but I want to tell you jokes, changing hands in Las Vegas alone. More jokes are working now than ever before.
We congratulate you.
And I congratulate you too. My funny Americans, my funny Americans, as you know, the road to excess is long and ridiculous. There is much work to be fun. It's going to take a lot of setups, a lot of satire, and a lot of shtick. But if we, together, dedicate ourselves to creating a lot of yucks, guffaws, chortles, chuckles, and giggles, ladies and gymnasts, the future holds nothing but premise. Thank you, and get naked.
For a free copy of this transcript, send 729 to Crime Prankster, Box 8, MoFo, Missouri. Offer limited, except in Nebraska where it's free. Parts sold separately. Batteries not included. Some assembly required. Your copy may vary, except in Nebraska where it's free. We refuse the right to reserve anyone. A salesman will call.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
To create is divine. To reproduce is human. Man Ray.
Bye-bye.